Brewing for July 26, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back and energized because I gotta tell you, Chapter 6 of The Valley of Fear, I have not read a bad paragraph in this novel so far.
The disco song. What would I name it, Steve?
A Dawning Light.
There you go, Pam.
Is that
we call it a Dawning Light. Get on the dance floor.
It's all coming clear, my friends. Remember how Watson has just been watching these three detectives at work, and that's how this chapter opens. The three detectives had many matters of detail into which to inquire, so I returned alone to our modest quarters at the Village Inn. But before doing so, I took a stroll in the curious old world garden which flanked the house. Rows of very ancient yew trees cut into strange designs girded it round. Inside was a beautiful stretch of lawn with an old sundial in the middle, the whole effect so soothing and restful that it was welcome to my somewhat jangled nerves. So this is a very pastoral moment. Watson's just enjoying a moment to himself, letting the detectives detect while he walks in the garden.
It's the picturesque.
But you guys...
Doyle only knows one kind of tree. He only knows yew trees. Have you noticed this?
Yeah, but what if they were my trees, not yew trees?
That's yew trees. It's in every story. Every story has yew trees. He really likes that kind of tree.
I had not noticed that, actually, but now that you point it out, I will going forward.
I'm going to do a search on the document to see if he uses any kind of other trees, but this is the fifth, sixth, seventh time that yew trees have been mentioned in the canon.
It's all about you.
Yeah.
Now, as Watson is walking along, just enjoying a spare moment to himself, he finds a mystery in the garden. As I approached the spot, I was aware of voices, some remark in the deep tones of a man, answered by a little ripple of feminine laughter. An instant later, oh, thank you, Steve. Great sound effects.
It's a Foley artist. It's the photo artist. It's not a Foley, photo artist.
An instant later, I had come around the end of the hedge and my eyes lit upon Mrs. Douglas and the man Barker before they were aware of my presence. Her appearance gave me a shock. In the dining room, she had been demure and discreet. Now, all pretense of grief had passed away from her. Her eyes shone with the joy of living, and her face still quivered with amusement at some remark of her companion. He sat forward, his hands clasped and his forearms on his knees, with an answering smile upon his bold, handsome face. This does not look good for Mrs. Douglas and Mr. Barker, does it?
No.
They were sad and somber, and now they're kind of giggly, maybe.
Yeah, they're giggling in the garden alone when they thought no one was watching. This is definitely not good.
But we know that Watson would never miss an opportunity to see something.
He sees it, he just doesn't observe it.
Now, Mrs. Douglas, he turns to go away, but they see him. One moment, Dr. Watson, cried the woman in a pleading voice. There is one question which you can answer with more authority than anyone else in the world, and it may make a very great difference to me. You know Mr. Holmes and his relations with the police better than anyone else. Supposing that a matter were brought confidentially to his knowledge, is it absolutely necessary that he should pass it on to the detectives? Now, what would your answer be to that question, my dear friends who have just read 59 Sherlock Holmes short stories?
Well, I'm going to answer this. I'm not an attorney, but, you know, imagine this is the type of question that an attorney could get asked. Listen, I've got some information, but if I tell you about it, you know, could it be used against me? You know, that type of question. And so he's asking Watson to feel out whether they should share with Holmes.
But, Pam, you're right. There is some precedent in the canon.
In like 20 of the stories.
For Sherlock Holmes to look at a case and to decide that there's some very good reason why he would not share that information with the police.
Well, there could be a boat waiting, you know, just to take them away, maybe to Australia.
Exactly, right?
Let me ask you a question before you tell me. Are you planning a trip to Australia?
Maybe you'll be on the boat tonight. Maybe you won't. And then nature can make, you know, nature can come in and judge you.
So it's so funny that you mentioned an attorney, Chip, because I kind of feel like Watson, he tries to be like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't really know. Then here's his final answer. Mr. Holmes is an independent investigator, I said. He is his own master and would act as his own judgment directed. At the same time, he would naturally feel loyalty towards the officials who are working on the same case, and he would not conceal from them anything which would help them in bringing a criminal to justice. Beyond this, I can say nothing, and I would refer you to Mr. Holmes himself if you want fuller information. So he pretty much sidesteps this. He doesn't tell them about all those boats to Australia or all those different decisions that have been made in the past.
And he's you're right. This is very much what a lawyer would say. I don't know. You could ask him.
And I'm gonna break in and just tell you, the morning show had a very similar situation in this. And there was a sexual misconduct moment of this, and the lady is kind of falling apart, and she's going to go up and tell the executive in charge of this division, and she's having a very difficult time to saying this. He can sense there's something going on. And he says, don't say a word. And he goes, I've been, you know, basically offers her a better job. But the point of it is, he doesn't want to hear it because he can always deny it. Right. And that is, I mean.
Plausible deniability is an important part of this investigation, for sure.
Sure, that's manipulative and it's wrong and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that this is, and certainly in a lot of stories, this certainly could. It's a good cue that there's something else going on.
Mm-hmm. And Watson does not fall for that trap. He's no dumbbell.
Good segue, Steve. Because we now arrive at the case of the missing dumbbell, which is, as you know, one of my favorite parts of this story. Now, when Watson gets back to the hotel, feeling like a little bit skeeved out, I would say, by his observations of Barker and Mrs. Douglas, Holmes is in great humor. He says, oh, no, 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 I don't want to know anything from Mrs. Douglas or Cecil. And he's super hungry and he's excited. Watson calls for high tea and off they go. He was in his most cheerful and debonair humor. My dear Watson, when I have exterminated that fourth egg, I shall be ready to put you in touch with the whole situation. I don't say that we have fathomed it, far from it, but when we have traced the missing dumbbell, the dumbbell? Dear me, Watson, is it possible that you have not penetrated the fact that the case hangs upon the missing dumbbell? Well, well, you need not be downcast, for between ourselves, I don't think that either Inspector Mack or the excellent local practitioner has grasped the overwhelming importance of this incident. One dumbbell, Watson. Consider an athlete with one dumbbell. Picture to yourself the unilateral development, the imminent danger of a spinal curvature. Shocking, Watson. Shocking.
And that is more words than Sherlock has said in chapters 1 through 5.
He's already there. He's got all those words saved up.
He's got it. He's got this case in the bag. And Watson knows this because he's eating. Sherlock does not eat when he's on a case. But now that he's got it solved, he's eating 4 eggs.
Well, you know, it's that fourth egg there that makes it. Yeah.
He has to exterminate the fourth egg before he can say a word. But, I mean, this is Sherlock in his very finest form, right? This is the detective. Super excited. He's just cracked it. Haha, cracked this case and all of those eggs. And, you know, Watson has no idea any more than you or I about what's going on with his dumbbell, but he can read Sherlock, right? As you just said, Steve, he sat with his mouth full of toast and his eyes sparkling with mischief, watching my intellectual entanglement. Oh, Watson.
Just like Mary Poppins, you know, having the tea.
The mere sight of his excellent appetite was an assurance of success, for I had very clear recollections of days and nights without a thought of food when his baffled mind had chafed before some problem, while his thin, eager features became more attenuated with the asceticism of complete mental concentration. So here we have the sort of two models of these two men's brains, the intellectual entanglement counterposed to the complete mental concentration. And we just have this wonderful enthusiasm for the way that the dumbbell has revealed all.
Enthusiasm's a great word, because that is where we've been for every chapter of this. There's been a great enthusiasm from all of the characters to solve this problem.
With a couple of dumbbells, you can work out the guns. You know what I'm saying?
Nope.
Just one dumbbell.
Don't know what you're saying.
Just one dumbbell. The spinal curvature alone, it's terrifying.
Sherlock reveals a conspiracy and muses about a hypothetical wife.
This part really made me smile. So by this point in time, Sherlock's pretty convinced that Cecil and Mrs. Douglas are lying. So I think part of the reason he doesn't need to hear their confidence is that I think he pretty much already knows, right? The man was shot long before the alarm was given, probably half an hour earlier when the housekeeper heard the door slam. But he asks, what were they doing during that half hour? Mm-hmm. So Watson jumps in. I am convinced myself, said I, that there is an understanding between those two people. She must be a heartless creature to sit laughing at some jest within a few hours of her husband's murder. Holmes agrees, exactly. She does not shine as a wife, even in her own account of what occurred. I am not a whole-souled admirer of womankind, you are aware, Watson.
I knew you would like that one, Chip. A whole-souled admirer of womankind.
Holmes continues, but my experience of life has taught me that there are few wives, having any regard for their husbands, who would let any man's spoken word stand between them and that husband's dead body. Should I ever marry, Watson, I should hope to inspire my wife with some feeling which would prevent her from being walked off by a housekeeper when my corpse was lying within a few yards of her. I just
Well, it just makes for a great dinner time conversation.
Can you imagine Sherlock bringing that up and going, well, dear, I want you to know that when I murdered, not if, when I murdered, you should come look at the body.
Right?
All right, so what is the, John Mulaney?
John Mulaney, when you're kidnapped,
smart start.
Not if.
Smart start. No.
When you're kidnapped, here's what you do. Not if. When?
Now, Holmes even continues on with just a little bit more discussion of what women tend to do. It was badly stage managed, for even the rawest investigators must be struck by the absence of the usual feminine ululation. If there had been nothing else, this incident alone would have suggested a prearranged conspiracy to my mind. So, a woman wants to see her dead husband, and she should also ululate a fair bit.
I hate it when that happens.
Take a note, ladies.
As a teacher, I don't get to ululate nearly enough.
Oh my god, this is there's so a schedule. This is so awesome.
This is great. This is great writing, and yes, it's so out of norm. This character of Sherlock Holmes has these ideas that are so outside of norm that it's wonderful entertainment. Yeah. Watson takes his place as the sounding board, and we get way more Sherlock Holmes than we've had in chapters 1 through 5.
Absolutely. And way more Watson, right? And so Holmes starts to chat. We will suppose that this couple are united by the bonds of a guilty love and that they have determined to get rid of the man who stands between them. It is a large supposition, for a discreet inquiry among servants and others has failed to corroborate it in any way. On the contrary, there is a good deal of evidence that the Douglases were very attached to each other. That, I am sure, cannot be true, said I, thinking of the beautiful smiling face in the garden. Well, at least they gave that impression. However, we will suppose that they are an extraordinarily astute couple who deceive everyone upon this point and conspire to murder the husband. He happens to be a man over whose head some danger hangs. We have only their word for that. Holmes looked thoughtful. I see, Watson, you are sketching out a theory by which everything they say from the beginning is false. According to your idea, there was never any hidden menace or secret society or valley of fear or boss Maxim buddy or anything else. So I love that was my favorite. Boss McGinty, right?
Boss Mac somebody. He completely, he's trying to be so detail oriented, but he is so dismissive of this part of the story. It's a Boss Mac somebody. I love that.
That is a nice little touch there as a writer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then after giving Watson an opportunity to make the case, Holmes carefully takes apart all of Watson's theory, one piece by one piece. Why did they use such a loud weapon? Why did they take the wedding ring, which would make you think that it has something to do with a relationship? And then why in the world would they leave the bicycle? That's the part that makes no sense. Came in on a bicycle. Why do you just leave your bicycle? How do you leave? So Watson, of course, as we've seen him do before, says, I can conceive of no explanation.
Duh, Holmes, I don't know.
Watson plays all of us.
Oh, yes. This is such a good mystery. This is coming together so well. We have, again, Doyle is giving us all of the clues that we need. We just need to suss through them and figure this out along with Watson.
Just on that, I've been thinking a lot about that drawbridge. How loud is it when it's put up and put down and things of that nature, and whether that could be part of what the cover is. I don't know. And, you know, a bicycle can always be used to come to you, not necessarily go away.
Elementary, my dear Chip.
Well, you know, they call me the Watson of these type stories.
So then we get another silly scene in this, Pam. This gets sillier
this
and sillier.
Is so funny to me.
Holmes asks to borrow Watson's umbrella.
Right. So they're at the inn, and he says, "I think that an evening alone in that study would help me much." "An evening alone," says Watson. "I propose to go up there presently. I have arranged it with the estimable Ames, who is by no means wholehearted about Barker. I shall sit in that room and see if its atmosphere brings me inspiration. I'm a believer in the genius loci. You smile, friend Watson. Well, we shall see. By the way, you have that big umbrella of yours, have you not?" And so what is Holmes doing? Why in the world does he want to go back to the murder scene in the study with Watson's umbrella? And Watson says, "Well, it's like not the greatest weapon, buddy."
Cue the Rihanna song. It's time to go ahead and put a placement there. She has a song named Umbrella. I'm sorry.
Okay, good. I was thinking more about the movie Clue once again in the sitting room with the umbrella. That's what I was thinking of.
The American Mercenary.
Boss Mick something.
The body master in the library with the candlestick.
We get to the American cyclist here, where we're introduced to some more concepts.
So finally Inspector Mac and Mason White arrive at the inn, and they say, "Oh my god, we found the owner of the bicycle. He's an American, and he is staying at a hotel. And the bicycle has been identified as his." "Well, well," said Holmes gleefully, "you have indeed done some solid work while I have been sitting spinning theories with my friend. It's a lesson in being practical, Mr. Mac." "Aye, it's just that, Mr. Holmes," said the inspector with satisfaction. And so we always know, right, that when Holmes is sitting spinning theories and other people are out doing the legwork, we know who's on to something and who's not. Not at all.
Mac and White think the American snuck in, hid in the curtains, shot Douglas, waded out through the moat, decided not to take the bicycle, and made it back to London some other way. Holmes thinks, instead, that Douglas was shot half an hour earlier than reported, and Mrs. Douglas and Cecil Barker know who did it and why, but they are concealing their information for reasons that we haven't yet discovered.
Holmes says that he's going to investigate, and no, he doesn't actually need any help. "Can we help you, Mr. Holmes?" asks Mac. No, Darkness and Dr. Watson's umbrella. My wants are simple. And Ames, the faithful Ames. No doubt he will stretch a point for me. All my lines of thought lead me back invariably to the one basic question. Why should an athletic man develop his frame upon so unnatural an instrument as a single dumbbell?
It all comes back to the dumbbell.
That's the clue. That's the one that we should have noticed, mm-hmm. along with that slipper. Doggone it.
And the umbrella, the big umbrella.
The umbrella. I'm perplexed by the umbrella that's somehow going to tie into his investigation. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic.
This is probably some 1940s dance routine that's coming up. That's why he had the umbrella.
The Rihanna song, 1940s Rihanna.
Steve, we have time travel, don't we?
Oh, yeah. There's time travel in this, for sure.
So, you guys... This brings us to a very odd ending, and I will be super interested what you guys thought about this ending. It was late that night when Holmes returned from his solitary excursion. We slept in a double-bedded room, which was the best that the little country inn could do for us. I was already asleep when I was partly awakened by his entrance. "Well, Holmes," I murmured, "have you found anything out?" He stood beside me in silence, his candle in his hand. Then the tall, lean figure inclined towards me. "I say, Watson, would you be afraid to sleep in the same room with a lunatic? A man with softening of the brain? An idiot whose mind has lost its grip?" "Not in the least," I answered in astonishment. "Ah, that's lucky," he said, and not another word would he utter that night. End of chapter. What do you make of this? Oh my goodness, what an odd whispered conversation. Waking Watson up and... My goodness, what is Holmes up to? And where's the umbrella?
Okay.
I don't read it as nearly as much of a romantic moment as you might inquire about Pam.
I don't either, you guys.
There's no spooning in this one.
Right, because they got two beds. They couldn't get a big bed.
No, it's... Oh.
You were reading it the opposite way, huh, Pam? That they should have gotten two rooms. Mm. They only had one room with two beds. I read it the opposite way. They couldn't find a big bed. They had to get two double beds. But I think that this is, once again, the Doctor Who moment where the genius of Holmes notices something that he didn't notice before, and he says out loud, "I am an idiot. I missed something. Mm-hmm. But now I know the solution."
Interesting. What do you think, Chip? You agree with that?
I don't disagree. I think that, you know, somewhere this story is almost solved, and I can't help but thinking it works like the other ones, where we eventually get whisked off somewhere so we can get the backstory to kind of play it out. Holmes has figured this out at this point. The question is whether I have, and the obvious answer is I'm going to be Watson here.
Right. I like that insight. I think that's exactly right. And I love that Watson is like, "I'm not afraid of idiots or lunatics. It's all good. I'm back.
Just come to bed."
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
So, my friends, that brings us within, there's only, the next chapter is chapter 7, The Solution.
Yeah, I was about to spoil the title of chapter 7 for Chip. Chapter 7, Chip, it's called The Solution.
Is that like where you mix some liquids together or something?
and that if this wasn't a morning show, yes.
That brings us to the end of part 1. After which we go to part 2, The Scourers. Mm-hmm. I look forward to.
I am absolutely looking forward to this. I've said it for a couple of chapters now. If I was in 1914 reading this monthly, I would absolutely be subscribed to this magazine by now. I am very much anticipating the next chapter. Every paragraph of this mystery has been wonderful.
And I just want to say, I was talking to a friend of mine today who's a Shakespearean scholar, Lynn Tribble at UConn, and she's doing a Shakespeare podcast today about Shakespeare and archery. And one of the questions they asked her is, what book would she take on a desert island? And she was not allowed to choose the Bible or Shakespeare. And what she chose was the complete works of Sherlock Holmes. And you guys, like, as we hit the 60th of these 60 stories, I can see that. Boy, we've read some good things. And this is one of the great books, I think.
And the canon, while it seems daunting, and yes, without COVID-19, you know, it's unlikely I would have gotten through all of it. This is certainly very manageable. I mean, mm-hmm. we did a short story a day. And then we did the books, you know, a chapter a day. And look where we are. We're almost finished with the entire canon.
I really have enjoyed this. I hope that everybody out there has enjoyed it. And yes, if you haven't been reading along with us, you really should. And now you've got our silly little commentaries to read and listen to so that you can get some idea of what this canon has for you. We would love to hear from you. We would love to hear the sound of your voice. We'd love to hear how you're doing. Send us an email or a voicemail. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes and go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these silly conversations so that you can have some communication amongst yourselves. And join us tomorrow, Chip, for Chapter 7, The Solution to This Mystery. How about that?
I'm going to bring coffee.
That's what we usually have. That's the best solution.
And four eggs.
And four eggs.
And Diet Pepsi.
And Diet Pepsi for parents. All right. So, this is exciting, and I'm ready to go.
There you go. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenplug.
And I'm Pam Bedore, welcoming you to the Valley of Fear. So we don't talk about